Good afternoon. Thank you, first of all, so much for inviting me to give the colloquium today. It's a great honor to speak in front of all of you. And I'm also very grateful that when the organizers of this program get together, we really would like to see through these two very different fields, arithmetic geometry and hyperbolic geometry, to come together, bringing two different groups of mathematicians, and to try to exchange ideas and try to find some common ground to work on. And we are very grateful that this was made possible by the support of the FUSE Institute. And so today I'm here to give you a very brief account of what we are interested in, why we want to bring these two groups of people together. And we have several organizers, which is a good thing. So because when you come down to who should do what, I will always look at John, you do it. And John will look at Steve Kula, and say, you do it, Steve. And but I'm very happy that our two local organizers, John Brandt, and Steve Kula, they are very kind to allow me to speak because I'm the guest, I guess. So, okay, so let me get to the main scientific program that we will be studying, I guess, in a week or two, in very shortly. So, let me see. Oops, I want both. Let me see if I got this work. Okay, no. Let me see how to go. I don't want this. Okay. Let me just make sure. You only control one. No. I think I. What's it? This is the new technology. Okay, that's okay. Let me try this. Now it works now. Okay. So, first of all, let me start from the arithmetic side. So, as we all know, at the beginning, we have the natural numbers. That's the beginning of everything. And then, shortly after that, we also begin to understand fractions. Yes? And after that, we understand all the integers. And then, all the rational numbers, which are all the fractions of plus and minus. But actually, it took a long time, particularly in certain culture, like in the Chinese mathematics, the number zero for thousands of years, that was not considered as a number. It was something mysterious about zero that the Chinese were very afraid of it. So like in the Chinese numeral, the number 1, 2, 3 are very simple. Everybody knows how to write that. One is just a horizontal, you draw horizontally one line, and then two would be two horizontal lines, three would be three horizontal lines. Well, four gets a little bit more complicated, but they are still very simple. But the number zero is a very complicated symbol. I think maybe I can write you somewhere over there. I don't know if you like to see it. It's something like, so that's one. Yeah? That's very simple. That's two. But zero is something like this. And this reflects that the culture for a long time did not understand that zero, okay? That really do not understand whether they should consider zero as a number. So conceptual things sometimes is quite difficult. Yeah, something that got stuck in our mind that we just couldn't overcome it. Okay, but eventually everybody agreed that zero should be a number. Okay, and then we also introduced absolute value, which I usually call the usual absolute value. We call the Archimedean absolute value, which we can change the negative to positive. Okay, and this becomes important later on as the number system begins to develop. So our ancestors begin to try to understand numbers. So the one thing that comes from necessity is that they begin to measure distance, measure length, and then come some formulas like equations. So equation is what we're interested in. So for instance, the Pythagorean theorem is C squared equals A squared plus B squared. And if you set A equal to 1 and B equal to 1, the equation becomes C squared equal to 2. So the solution is C is square root of 2. And in those days, that was thousands of years ago, people were puzzled about what is square root of 2. And they begin to realize that this is not like any number that they have understand before, like it's not a rational number. It took them a long, long time to realize that this is not a rational number. Yeah, but the proof is not that easy. I think the first probably rigorous proof is due to Euclid. That proved that square root of 2 is not a rational number. Okay. So, and then once they understand that square root of 2 is not a rational number, many other irrational numbers are then also discovered. Okay. Among these, of course, is the number pi, which of course probably has something to do with the invention of the wheels. But it took a long, long, long time for mathematicians to show that, so it's until 1776, that pi is indeed an irrational number. And it takes even longer to realize that this is a new kind of irrational number. It's different from square root of 2. It is something that we now call transcendental numbers. So what is a transcendental number? So an algebraic number is a number that you've gotten from by solving an equation, an algebraic equation, like x squared equal to 2, so x equal to square root of 2. So square root of 2 comes from the solution of a polynomial. So it's an algebraic number. But on the other hand, so things that are not irrational number, that does not come from solutions of polynomials, are called transcendental. And it took a long time for people to show that pi is indeed a transcendental number. And the problem can be looked at from a geometric point of view. For thousands of years, geometers tried to, what is now known called squaring the circle. So what it means is that we know that the area of a circle of radius r is pi r squared. So when radius is 1, so you get pi. The area of a circle of radius 1 is pi. So the problem is to find a square whose area is pi. The catch. The catch is that you are only allowed to construct this square using only straight edge. So a ruler but without markings and the compass. And it turns out that this procedure, if you're able to do this, this means that that number, so in this case, x equal to square root of pi, would be algebraic. But in the old days, people didn't know that this cannot be done. So many generations of mathematicians spent a great deal of effort trying to square the circle. And it was not until Lindemann, in the 18-something, he shows that for sure that this can never be done. Pi is indeed a transcendental number. Okay? So after that, before that, we already begin to understand better about calculus. So the concept of limit begin to really understand the concept of limit, and then the absolute value that we talk about comes into play, and we now know that the number system, the real number system, are just the limits with respect to Archimedean absolute value. So we get the real number. And if I have time later on, I'll introduce another absolute value. These are called a periodic absolute value. Then you've got different kinds of number. What are the periodic numbers? But for most purpose, we are working with the real numbers. And then we also, of course, later on, understand that we can solve x squared equal to minus 1. So that's the imaginary number, and we got the complex number system. Okay, so that's a basic number system that we are, except that there are also something called periodic numbers. Okay, so let's get back to transcendental number. So let me give you something very brief. We are not going to spend much time on this, just to give you some history that people for many, many years were fascinated by transcendental numbers. So it took a lot of effort by many distinguished mathematicians, Lampert, Liouville, Hermite, they show that certain special numbers are transcendental numbers, like e, like pi, 1 over e, e to the pi, things like that. And then the examples of transcendental numbers grew and grew to the point that people begin to think perhaps we should have a better theory about what is going on. So then in 1900, in the 2nd International Congress, Hilbert posed 23 very famous problem. The 7th problem is about transcendental number. So what he's saying is that if alpha, beta, these are algebraic numbers, but if you look at alpha to the beta, all of these should be transcendental. So if you take e, so e to the 1 is a transcendental number, but of course you don't have to take the base e. What he's saying is that even if you take something alpha, which is like an algebraic number, alpha to the beta would have to be something like this. 2 to the square root of 2 should be transcendental. And at the time, Hilbert thinks that this problem is probably harder than Fermat's last theorem and the Riemann hypothesis. Now, Fermat's last theorem, we know, thanks to some very famous people who solved the Fermat's last theorem, but I think Riemann hypothesis is still open, right? At least I didn't check the internet today, but I haven't checked everybody's notebook. Maybe someone has a proof, but did not have the notebook is not big enough to write down the proof. Okay, so at least I know that. But that Hilbert's opinion is actually that this problem is very difficult, but it turns out not to be the case. The reason being that function theory, that the transcendental numbers are very intimately related to function theory. And function theory had more tools. And this make the resolution of this problem, in some sense, easier. So this was the Hilbert 7 problem was solved in 1929 by A.O. Galfond and also someone else. Did I mention the name? Schneider. In 1934. Okay, so why am I interested in transcendental numbers? I'm interested in transcendental numbers through the theory of transcendental functions. Okay, so transcendental functions include many, almost every important function that you can name are transcendental. For example, the Waldgraf's P function, the Riemann theta function, or the theta functions that you look at, they are all of this type. And then the first person that really looking at this through function theory, perhaps Siegel, one of my favorite mathematicians in the history of mathematics, and he is the first one who began to look at all these problems through function theory. He wanted to have a better understanding, better explanation of why is it so difficult for people to prove that something is transcendental. And at first they do it one at a time, e, and then they prove that e is a transcendental number, and then prove square root of e is a transcendental number. It took a lot to show that 1 over e is a transcendental number. Yeah, and sort of like one at a time. So that's actually a good idea. We can hire more people and take longer. If we can take longer to prove everything, just one at a time. But doing things one at a time. But what Siegel was doing is that he just take a transcendental function, and then he asked, what are the algebraic value? So you take an algebraic number field. So you take a function. So function is from, say, the domain is a complex number, so I'm allowing rational or meromorphic things, so I allow extended value. And then he asks, what is the preimage of something that's algebraic? How big can this set be? And if you found all of this set, then the complement, you get all the transcendental number, or as many as you want. And it comes as a surprise that it's very small. That is the thing that, if you take a transcendental function, and you fix a number field, algebraic number field, the pre-image is finite. And in fact, his result is actually, there are some assumptions that I didn't put, I'll show you the assumption, precise assumption that comes in there, is that there's very few. So this, roughly speaking, if you take a transcendental function, you plug in something, you expect most of the time, 99.9% of the time, or more, that you should get something transcendental. So in one stroke, things become more apparent. Okay? So, and Siegel's work nowadays is reformulated in more modern terms and extended by search lang. Okay, I'll come back to search lang later. The most general form at this time of questions of this type is due to Bombieri. And since it's one of my favorite theorem, I'm going to tell you what his statement is. It's a little bit technical in nature, but roughly, he takes a whole bunch of transcendental functions and puts some mild condition. This turns out to be very natural condition, and that under this condition, he showed that his result works for any dimension. Remember, Siegel only looked at when the domain is C, it's one variable. So he is now extending it to any number of variables, and he showed that the algebraic values are contained in the zero set of a polynomial. So he did not say that it's finite, he said that the inverse image, all the algebraic are contained in something which is polynomial, is the crucial word. So in case of one variable, a polynomial can have only a finite number of roots, so you do get finiteness in the case of Siegel, under some technical assumption. Okay? This technical assumption basically condition like this means that you satisfy some kind of differential equation. So for example, you take the exponential function, you differentiate the exponential, you got to itself. So it's some closeness condition. So it's some kind of differential equation condition right there. Okay? So most of the reals like Riemann theta function, Bauschus P function, they are some equation. They have to obey some rules. So these are the rules that you have to show. I satisfy this condition and then you can get to the conclusion. Okay. But what we are interested in when we try to propose to have a special program, we have to write some proposal to the fields. This is one of the problems that we propose, that we try to understand. The reason being that Bombieri's proof, it's really extremely interesting. He started out by looking from the point of view of number theory. So he tried to derive under this condition, you're trying to find the algebraic value, what's going to go. So you use number theory and try to prove something. So you deduce the possible consequence, and he couldn't quite get to the theorem. Then he go around and start from the point of view of complex analysis. And amazingly, the proof use the L2 estimate of Hollander, which was developed for complex analytic function. And Hollander got the Fields Medal for his L2 estimate plus his work on PDEs. And Hollander got looking from that point of view and he tried to figure out some invariant and as he was doing that, you can see that the two theory begin to somehow come together, the number theory and the complex analysis. There are some magical things between the two theory that eventually the number theory and the complex meet at some point, and the answer then of the proof of the theorem just drops right out of that very naturally onto your lap. Okay, so at the time we were thinking was that now Bombieri did not claim finiteness. So in our proposal, one of the problems is that we try to understand what's going on here. When do we get finiteness? In one variable case, we get finiteness. So when we first proposed this, we were not sure how far we can go. But since I was invited, Barbara emailed me to come and give a talk, and I decided, I would take the opportunity to come a little bit earlier, so I came This is already, I'm here for the second week. I come here to work with my co-organizers, particularly John here. And now we are getting to the point that at first it was just a wishful thinking that we should be able to come up some quite reasonable understanding of this situation, so we would be able to do something about this. Okay, so now let me then, now these are the periodic, maybe I will skip this for the moment about periodic, as I want to move to the main, if I have time to come back to this. The thing about AG and HG, our proposal is to try to understand the Diophantine approximation. So let me tell you a little bit of the Diophantine approximation. So the basic problem is that you are given an equation. So it's like when we are in elementary school, middle school, and we try to solve x squared plus 2x plus 1 equal to 0, find the root. Yeah, the teachers would tell us to do that. This is what we are doing. Okay? So the Diophantine is, so suppose you have some equation, and the coefficients of the equation, they are integers, and you ask, can you find integer solution? These are the Diophantine problems. Okay? But in general, this may look very innocent problem, but actually in reality it's quite difficult. And usually, as a first step, we ask a little bit easier question first. And the question is that, can you tell us when you get a finite number of integer solutions? To explain this, let's look at an example. So the equation would be x cubed minus 2y cubed equal to 1. I just write this randomly. These are the coefficients 1 and 2 and minus 2 and 1. You can put your favorite numbers there. If 7 is it, you can put 7, you can put 11, whatever your favorite number is. And we try to solve this equation. Okay, I start with x cubed because x squared, I think, maybe a little bit too easy, right? So let's look at this problem. So let's look at, as usual, I like to start with some special case. So let's set y equal to 0. Then in that case, the equation is x cubed minus 1 equal to 0. Now this is 0. So, and that you can factorize. Usually that's how we do it in high school. We factorize the equations, x cubed minus 1, we factorize it. So you would have three roots, three solutions, and only one of them is integer. These other two, these are, theta is called the primitive root. Yeah. So there are some negative, there's some imaginary number that's here. So you get 1. So that's too easy. So let's say what is the general case. Okay, so maybe I would like to, let me see if I can. Okay, so let me keep that for comparison. So here, how do we do it? So now we're at the general. So what we do is we divide by y cubed. Once you divide by y cubed, we look at the left-hand side. So it's something cubed minus 2. There we have minus 1. So minus 2 is similarly, you can factorize it. So except that now the right-hand side is not 0. So we cannot say that these are the roots. But then we observe that this theta, this x and y are rational numbers. X and y are supposed to be integer solutions. So these are rational numbers. And these have imaginary things. So these two factors here, they are kind of far off from each other. The rational number cannot get too close to the imaginary number. So what this means, if you think about it a little bit, means that we have a bound. We have an inequality with some constant c. The constant c comes from here. Try to estimate there, so you get this estimate. So then we get some room to operate. The room to operate is something more flexible, inequality. So what we're asking is that now, approximating square root, the cube root of 2 by rational numbers, meaning how many rational numbers can satisfy this inequality. This again looks something like, it seems to be very innocent, but it's quite difficult. The answer is provided by the famous Rawls lemma, and Rawls got the Fields Medal for this lemma. Is that Rawls lemma over there? Yeah. So the Rawls lemma there Okay, now let me turn it off now. Okay, so because I have very poor eyesight, that far I cannot see, so I have to rely on this one. So Rohr's lemma precisely is answering the question of approximation. So he says that if you have irrational algebraic number, you try to approximate a rational number, then if you look at inequality like this, you can only have finite possibility. So the important thing about this lemma is the two, I want you to remember the 2 plus epsilon. This turns out to be a very crucial number. There were people before Rohr's that got some other number, but this is turns out to be the optimal number, and we'll see later that this number will appear also in function theory. So at this point, this is technical, but 2 plus epsilon is what I want you to remember. And what this does is that if you apply to our example, this is what it says is that when we, the example that we look at, that inequality there, we have x, y to the cube. So it would, if this is true for finite, then if you replace the 2 plus epsilon by cube, it would also be true and it would also be finite. So we have shown that you can have at most finitely many integer solution of this equation. Okay, so it's reduced to an estimate. Okay, and let me just briefly say that there's something called effective Rohr's lemma. Is that you, if you know something about this constant C, if you can tell us, if you can work out what this number C is in a certain problem, then actually you're able to tell how many solutions there are, because then you can, in principle you can, by using computer or whatever to help you find the solution. Okay, so that is it. And for purple, that will become a little bit clearer a little bit later when I talk about what is the function theory in the Vanina theory. It is, nowadays, we write the Rohr's lemma in the logarithmic form. In other words, I take the Rohr's lemma, I just take log. So again, it's a 2 plus epsilon over here that I want you to remember. And then I'll introduce the function theory. But before that, let's look at the problem geometrically. This is arithmetic geometry. How does geometry comes into play? Here we can look at the problem of solving the Diophantine equation in a different way. So the usual way, so let's go back to the equation x cubed plus 2y cubed equal to 1. So the first step people usually do is replace the 1 by a variable c to the cube. This is called homogenization. So you x cubed, y cubed, and c cubed. Okay, so we replace the 1 by this variable and make this thing homogeneous. Same power. And what this means is that this equation defines a curve in projective space, P2. The reason is that here, the homogeneity, that you can multiply x, y, z by a factor lambda, then everybody have lambda cubed comes out, it cancels out. So what it means is that you're working on projective space and looking at curve. In this case, a curve of degree 3 in projective 2 space. And for curve, for complex analysis people, when we say curve, it's real dimension 2, so I'm really talking about Riemann surface. And for curves, there is a very important invariant called the genus. And the genus of a curve. Then genus 0, we call it a rational curve. Genus 1, we call it an elliptic curve. So really, elliptical is just a torus, if you like to think of it that way. Rational curve is a Riemann sphere. Okay, so genus 0, genus 1, and then everybody else called general type. Genus of 2 or more are called general type. So most people are here, they are 2 distinguished ones. And then there is a very famous genus formula in terms of the degree. So in the case of curve is smooth, G is equal to D minus 1, D minus 2 over 2. So in the case when for that equation there, is 3 minus 1, 3 minus over 2 is 1. So this is an elliptic curve. It's a torus. Okay? So for example. Then what we have is that, but our original equation is not, c cubed was 1, so that means c cannot be 0. So what we are looking at is the curve. The example we're looking at is the c, you pick out something at infinity. What we call the infinity is when c equal to 0. Okay? So Rohr's theorem says that if you take an elliptic curve, pick up some point at infinity, then the number of integer points is finite. And this is a classical theorem first due to Siegel. That rational curve pick up 3 points. So Riemann sphere, you remove 3 points, then the complement has only finite and integer points. For elliptic curve like torus, you only have to remove 1 point, the complement has only also finite and point. So this is the geometric way of looking at it in terms of genus. And then Fortings, his famous paper shows that for genus bigger than equal to 2, everybody has only finitely many rational points. So this is one part of his Fields Meadow paper. And so these are the geometrical way of looking at the Fenton equation. So in the solving equation, we can look at it also geometrically. Okay. So I just here maybe go through it very quickly. Is that everything can be extended, the raw theorem can be extended to higher dimension. There's something called the Schmidt subspace theorem, which is very famous. But the crucial thing is the n plus 1 plus epsilon in higher dimension. So when one variable is 2, 1 plus 1, 2 plus epsilon. These are the crucial things. Okay? So again, you can write it in logarithmic form. So now I'll come back to this again, but now it's time to look at the way that function theory people looking at the problem. So again, function theory people, complex analysis, are also looking at solutions of equations. But the solutions now that they are looking for are not like integers or anything like that. They are looking solution in function space. So for example, you take x squared plus y squared equal to 1, that's a rational curve, and then you see that the solution sine squared plus cosine squared is 1. So you're looking for solutions that are functions. Okay? And suppose that the interesting thing is that, so suppose you go back to that equation, you're looking for holomorphic solution now, looking for solutions that are functions. And in complex analysis, it's known in hyperbolic geometry that the only possibility are constants. So this is the concept of hyperbolicity. So what it says is that if you have a complex space like a curve that I just wrote down, x squared plus minus 2y cubed equal to 1, if you have a solution, a holomorphic solution, then the only possibility that they are constant, such a space, is called hyperbolic. So E was an elliptic curve. You take out a point, it is hyperbolic. These are classical theorems. So it's just, and the remarkable thing is that these three statements are exactly the three statements that we just seen in the Fenton geometry. Exactly the same. Except the conclusion, except that we are looking in a different category. We're looking at function theory. But from the point of hyperbolicity, for function theory and from arithmetic geometry, finiteness, the theorems are exactly the same. So they suggest that there's a deeper relation between them. And more than that, we have the raw theorem, but in the Vanina theory, in the 1920s actually, the Vanina proved something called a second main theorem. The second main theorem in logarithmic form looks something like this. It's too technical. Let's not worry about it. The only important thing is the left hand side is some kind of approximation, just like the Fenton approximation. We are approximating now with functions. Okay? In the left hand side, somehow the 2 plus epsilon comes up. And these are also sharp. So exactly the same. And you can, these are, so it's approximation, so that's why I call proximity function. Okay? And then you can also do it in higher dimension, then it's like the Smith subspace theorem, the only difference is that exactly the same fact, same expo, n plus 1 plus epsilon comes up. So forms are exactly the same, and these numbers are also exactly the same. Okay? So this is, function theory. So it suggests that there should be some relation between the two theories. And then Voita is one of the organizers of our program and came up with a formal dictionary. This formal dictionary allows you to do some translation, not do any statement or any theorem into your Fenton approximation. If you use a dictionary, translate into a statement in hyperbolic geometry. And vice versa. But at this point, this dictionary is still on a, at a formal level. What we would like to is to be able to understand it in a, you know, something more basic, so that there are some basic theorem which tells you that if you look at integers, then you get to be offending. You look at function fields, then you look at hyperbolicity. So that was the main thing. Okay. But actually, so you might say, oh, this is totally formal. But it's a little bit better than that. That the correspondence between the two is more, much more precise. So here's the basic principle. It says that, so you can, the dictionary tells you that you can translate one statement to the other statement. Actually, the dictionary actually tells you that if you work things right correctly, you can actually translate the proof. So the principle is that in hyperbolic geometry, you can, if you can arrange the proof of your theorem using only the second main theorem. Because in function theory, there are also some other special techniques. But if the proof use only second main theorem, then this proof can be translated to a theorem in the offending geometry. And that proof would use only the Rolle-Smith theorem and vice versa. And this indeed had been done. I just give you some brief examples. So one is the generalization of Siegel theorem into higher dimension. So Siegel is that you take P1, you take out 3 points, remember? Then it is 3 distinct points, you get finiteness of integral points. But it was not known that this is true if you replace P1 by Pn. So, but in the Menino theory, it is known that if you take P1, you take out 2n plus 1 hyperplanes in general position, then the complement is hyperbolic. So this translated to using Voigt's dictionary is that Pn, you take out 2n plus 1 hyperplanes in general position, if these hyperplanes are defined over integers, then the complements will have only finitely many integral points. So that is the statement. And then indeed, one can prove this statement in complex analysis using only second main theorem. And then with that, you translate, you get a proof for the offending, the arithmetic geometry about Siegel's, extending Siegel's theorem to higher dimension. Okay, the Pn take out 2n plus 1, you have, indeed have finitely many integral points. Now, this is also a theorem. This is a result due to myself and Min Ru, who is also an organizer of this conference. And more recently, 2003 or 4, Kovaha and Sanya extend Schmidt's subspace theorem to not just hyperplane, but also hypersurfaces at any degree D. After they extend this theorem, the proof was then translated by Min Ru and used now the so-called second main theorem of hypersurface. So it goes back and forth. That you get one theorem, one theory, and then the other side, hey, I can probably do something about it and translate it and somehow come up with a corresponding theorem. So these are now theorem, and Kovaha and Sanya would also be coming to our program to give up to give us their insight. Okay. So here is just very brief account of some of the important things. Not every theorem at this moment the proof are translatable because each theory sometimes develop their special tools, but basically, when you go through those proofs, you see that the ideas are almost exactly the same. Even though the proofs are not directly translatable, the ideas are very similar. And among these are some famous theorems. In the complex hyperbolic geometry, there's a Brock theorem, which is in 1926, but received a lot of attention in the 1990s about something about abelian varieties. Okay? And also, during that time, there's also so-called Lange's conjecture, again, dealing with abelian varieties and some theorem that are due to Siu and Yang, and Siu is, and they're also coming for our program. About the same time, the corresponding statement in the offending approximation was proved by Fautings. Both statements, the Brock theorem and the Siu and Yang theorem. And this was all conjectured by Schutzlang that they should be true, both sides. And if you look at that proof, the proof are very similar. The ideas are very similar, but the technical details, they use some special technique. What is the, for example, what are the special techniques that you have in a complex analysis that you don't have in number theory is differentiation. So when complex analysis try to solve an equation, one thing they can get extra equation is just by differentiation. You get differentiation, you can sort of keep differentiating until you get enough information. So this is a higher order information. And this is much harder to do in number theory. In number theory, you can do something called finite quotient, but you cannot take limit. So you have to work something somehow harder. Okay? So these are now very major and famous theorems. Okay. Okay. So now let me mention, so I hope I have convinced you that there are some very intimate relationship between the two theory, but let me just say some of the open part. This is the biggest one that we would like to understand. This is formulated by Search Lang. Search Lang is really the person that at first nobody believed him when he's making this outlandish conjecture and statement, but now we understand that he has a lot of insight into it. So he coined some terminologies, like something modalic, that means you have finiteness. This is a concept in the Fenton. So a projective is said to be modalic. The number of k-resonant points is finite. And then you have this hyperbolicity. What he is saying is that this precise statement that if x is modalic, if and only if x is hyperbolic, if and only if every subvariety of x is of general type. So this is something that needs to be fully understood. This is the biggest problem in this area. And for this to really work, we have to have a better understanding of what is going on underlying both theories. So let me just quickly mention one more, is that about second main theorem and the Rorschach-Smith theorem. Actually, the second main theorem in complex analysis, there's a stronger form due to Alfors, where he got the Fields Medal. He introduced an extra term. This is a term which involves derivatives, and it's not this result, this statement is not translatable at this point in number theory. So we hope that at some point we can do that to understand better, because some of the theorem in complex analysis rely on this stronger form. So let me just skip that through very quickly, just to briefly say that we are expecting that it should be possible to get a better understanding of all this. So I just mentioned these two open problems. I will skip this about periodic numbers, perhaps. I think my time is running out soon. So let me just, to end this, to say a few words about our program. So at this point, we have the activities that we are going to have are two major workshops, one in arithmetic geometry and one in hyperbolic geometry. And many distinguished researchers will be coming to give talks in this major workshops, and also we have this distinguished lecture series. By Yamtong Xie from Harvard in complex geometry, and the Cox lecture series by So Wu Zhang from Columbia in arithmetic geometry. And this is the part about periodic. There's a relationship between complex and periodic through the complex dynamical system and periodic dynamical system. And we are now having two mini workshops in this area. Again, you see the relationship between complex analysis and number theory. And we also are having a lot of short-term visitors coming to give many seminars. So there will be a lot of activities, and hope that we can attract a lot of people coming here in the fall. And also, we strongly believe that we also should have an educational component, so we are planning for three mini courses for graduate students. One in arithmetic geometry by Gile, and I will do the hyperbolic geometry. Guo would be connecting the two. So these are the things that we are planning for in the fall. Okay, and I would like to thank the Fields Institute for supporting our project, and I think that is it, and I thank you for your patience. Okay, thank you.